Joe Dabney is the author of, among other books, Mountain Spirits and Smokehouse Ham Spoonbread and Scuppernong Wine, which won a James Beard Award as Best Book of the Year. He's a native of South Carolina. He's been a strong presence in the Southern Foodways Alliance since our beginnings. Joe spoke at our third conference on what happens when Southerners and Southern food take off down the road. Joe is a native of South Carolina. He now lives in Cartersville, Georgia, and Atlanta sometimes. We're very pleased to have him with us today, Joe Dabney.
Thank you, John. Well, good afternoon. Y'all ready for a little white lightning? Well, I'm sorry. I don't have any samples. Not here, but we'll be patient. Tonight, we'll try to have some at the event tonight. You know, when I wrote Mountain Spirits, it's been quite a while now. I'm going to play some tapes a little later. And these are really 30 years old. So everything that you hear on these tapes, just remember that, you know, we were talking about three decades ago. But when I wrote Mountain Spirits, invariably people would come up at signings and they would say, do you have any samples? The heck with the book, we want some samples. So we will have some tonight later. And of course, those of you who do participate in a little tasting, I want to warn you that this will give you a chance to discover why many people call this stuff, really call it white lightning. I guess the best description of the taste of moonshine, and of course there's no government regulation that tells you what proof, what the ingredients are, or whatever. Like for instance, bourbon, you have 51% corn, and the government does describe corn whiskey as 80% corn, but when you get to moonshine, boy, the sky's the limit. So you really don't know what you're getting, but it's always good to know who your maker is. But I guess about the best description of moonshine was given by this guy up in Sugar Valley, Georgia. He came up and his uncle's truck was smelling, had a little apple-ish smell to him. He said, "What do you have there?" He said, "I have a little brandy there." A little moonshine brandy. He said, well, he was pretty well experienced in alcoholic beverages, so he just took this jug of brandy and he chug-a-lugged it down, and he went running off, and he said, "Damn, I must have farted fire." Well, I'm delighted to get the chance to give you a little of my experiences in researching. I guess really the best way to tell you about moonshining and moonshiners is just to tell you, just to go through with you a little of my experiences in researching Mountain Spirits. You know, the working title of the book back in 1970 was The Decline and Fall of Corn Whiskey as a Fine Art. And I of course, was totally ignorant of the subject when I started researching it. And I sent letters around to a lot of people, and one of which went to the Chattanooga Times, and they said, he's writing a saga of pure corn. So that was the working title from then until the time the Scribner's editors got hold of it, and they said, you know, this sounds like a book of corny jokes, so we need something a little more definitive. How about Moonshining and Moonshiners? And of course, we had that subtitle, A Chronicle of Corn Whiskey from King James Ulster Plantation to America's Appalachians. I wrote him a long letter, and I said, hey, this is a bigger story than just moonshining. This is a story of America. This is a story of American history. Even George Washington had a still at Bogue Creek, and Lafayette was said to be astounded by the swift authority of the Mount Vernon spirits. He made apple brandy, and he made brandies, and he made rye whiskey there. Well, anyway, they said, okay, we'll go back to the drawing board, and so they did. And one night I got a telegram, and it said, how about Mountain Spirits, a Chronicle Corn Whiskey from King James Ulster Plantation to America's Appalachians, and the Moonshine Life. That's where they added the moonshine part. And I said, super dandy, and that's what we went with. Well, I think, of course, the greatest thing that I enjoyed in doing all this research was getting to meet a lot of the people. And people said, how in the world did you get hold of all those folks? And I said, I talked to retirees. And I brought along a number of tapes. And the first one that I'd like to play for you is one of Hamper McBee. He's a rollicking character from Mott Eagle, Tennessee, long since deceased, God bless his soul, tall, rip-roaring character, who liked to call himself the Cumberland Moonshiner. I've had many interviews, and I taped a lot of conversations with Hamper, but this one that I'd like to play for you is one that was produced and was put out by Veranda Records in the 1970s. It's a very difficult record to get hold of, but let's listen to Hamper McBee.
I tell you, people make whiskeys what they've always done. I know some people don't know nothing else. Don't know how to do nothing else. Ain't never done nothing else. Don't know nothing else, wouldn't do nothing. But I tell you what, ain't no lazy man gonna make no whiskey. I hear a lot of them old women around down home, and so and so too lazy to work, all they do make whiskey. They ought to try it sometime if they think it's a snap. Packing that rye sugar down them mountains and getting wet and slicking you a falling and a stumbling and a getting down there and a chopping wood and it wet and trying to get a farm and run that stuff and don't know what they're gonna run in and grab you any minute or not. Gonna have to pack that stuff back out of them mountains. Then if you don't put right back up in, you gotta go back there and heat you slop up when you put your sugar back up. It's a blooming job. If you got a big outfit, it'll work a half a dozen people a day.
Hamper, if you want to applaud him, go ahead. I tell you, he was really, I wish he'd have been on some TV shows because he was absolutely great. Well, when I started researching this subject, I was, as I said, I was totally ignorant, and I thought I could finish this book in about 6 months. Well, I got so intrigued with the subject, I spent the holidays, vacations, all my vacations from Lockheed, and weekends. I traveled over 5,000 miles. North Georgia, of course, East Tennessee, Western North Carolina, and on up into Kentucky. I accumulated over 50 cassettes of interviews that I obtained from about a dozen moonshiners, plus about the equal number of revenuers. And as in all the books that I've done, I really just fell in love with these people. You know, I thought they would be very difficult to reach and to talk to, but really, these folks just opened up their hearts to me and their homes, and I was really overwhelmed. As you might imagine, this was a fun part of the job, except for the time when one moonshiner mistook me for a revenuer, and it beat the living daylights out of me over in the low country of South Carolina when I was working for the Florence Morning News. But Federal Judge Weiss there, He didn't think it was a joke, and he sentenced Robert Blue of Bennettsville, South Carolina he revoked his probation and sent him to the federal pen for an extra 5 years. And I'll tell you more about that later. But actually, that happened before I was doing all this research, and as I say, I was just an unwitting victim at that time. Someone asked me, why in the world would you tackle a subject, such a wild and crazy subject as moonshining? And I said, the devil made me do it. Actually, as I say, I was looking for a book subject. I had tried to start off writing a book on sort of a juvenile biography, and I started on the idea of Gutzon Borglum, who did that first great carving on Stone Mountain and got fired and ended up in the Great Hills up in the Dakotas and did wonderful up there. Of course, it was a lot softer rock. But But the publishers said young readers do not take to artists. And so I tried again. And so I was coming back from North Georgia with the family, and I stopped our station wagon in Dawsonville, Georgia. There was a billboard that said, "Visit the world's only moonshine museum." So I pulled off from the little circle there in little Dawsonville, Georgia, 50 miles north of Atlanta, and I found it. And this museum was in a chicken house. Of course, those chicken houses in North Georgia and here in Mississippi and in Alabama, they're pretty big. And this one was about 100 feet long and about 40 feet wide. And inside were four stills, a copper pot, a groundhog, a steamer, and a pan. And the operator, Fred Goswick, said each one of these stills represented an era of Appalachian history and whiskey history. And he told me a lot of things that really sparked my imagination. First, he told me about the migration of the Scotch-Irish people who came and other Celts who came into that area in the 1800s. He told me about Atlanta's first mayor, Moses Formwalt, who came down from East Tennessee. And he was a still maker at Five Points, right down the heart of downtown Atlanta, Moses Formwalt. He later got shot by a prisoner over in DeKalb County. And he told me about how these people up in the Dahlonega and Dawsonville areas would wagon whiskey into Atlanta. And then later, of course, was the beginning of the good old boys, particularly in, say, like in the late 30s and the 40s, there are 39 Fords and 40 Fords. They would run whiskey into Atlanta during the week, and then on Sunday they would go out and race on that dirt Lakewood Speedway. That was actually the beginning of NASCAR. And, I saw the makings of a book there, and I researched the fool out of it. I researched it so much that I got locked up in the Atlanta Public Library one night when the lights went out at 9 o'clock and I was down in the catacombs and I didn't get out until midnight. And I was able to get on the phone and get the janitor to come in and let me out. But I found in all of my research, my early research, that for 243 years of colonial and national history, the making of corn whiskey was a very popular free enterprise. No taxes up until the Civil War, no inspections, no OSHA. By golly, it was just a wonderful way of, and the economics were compelling. A horse could carry only 4 bushels of corn, but he could carry the equivalent of 24 bushels if he distilled it down into the alcoholic and variety. And that would be 2 8-gallon kegs. Whiskey was the money of the frontier. Stronger than the continental dollar, easily divided, improved with age, with a few barrels of whiskey like Abraham Lincoln's father, you could buy a farm. It was a medicine of the frontier. Mountain folks had a saying, here's to corn liquor, whitens the teeth, perfumes the breath, and makes childbirth a pleasure. But as I say, the most enjoyable part for me was interviewing these characters, all of them retirees. I really never did go to a live still, honest. I never did, for God's. But let me introduce you now to Theodore King of Gumlock, Georgia, the late Theodore King, one of Senator Zell Miller's first supporters, a Lincoln lookalike. Let's listen to Theodore King.
Well, a half a bushel of dry corn mold. We used to use green to hurry, not give it time to dry, but dry corn mold to bed, and you put a peck of rye meal. That's 2 gallon of rye meal to the box. That's sherry.
Yeah.
To make a cap.
Right.
And so then you can put, we used to put 25 pounds of sugar in the box. We used to put 50 pounds, but anymore you want to put 100 pounds of sugar to the box.
Mm-hmm.
Stir it up good, and I have worked it off in 24 damn hours, but we'll say about 72 hours, then you get and lay down in water, right. And that's the best. But you
all right? Let me wait just a minute now. Let's see if I understand. Now you got these four boxes now, and you put your cap on there. Now.
You're
going to have a sweet mash right on your
head. That'll be the sweet mash when it works.
You're not putting any sugar on that first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How much sugar are you putting in
the box? Well, you can put 100 pounds in a box.
100 pounds each one of the boxes.
Yeah.
All right, now how long does it take to ferment?
Well, I have done it in 24 hours. In fact, the minutes I broke it up, like I see it, go back in the morning, clear off, and it don't make nothing.
Right.
It all depends on the weather.
Yeah.
And I can't figure it out. It all depends on a lot of things. You go back when it just, what I mean, blow its top, the bowl flat, you've got to run it. If you don't, it'll vinegar.
Yeah,
you've got to
grate it and go into vinegar.
And I run it to where it wasn't eaten by gosh bead. Just back it.
That's all right.
You have to recook it. But now when it lays down there and works, well, when you already leave, it'll be a pimpling. You can put your ear to it and hear it pimpling.
Yeah.
Sound like. Then go back the next morning and it's giving it that.
You mean it's getting foamed up?
Yeah, and that rye caps up there. I'll see the cap on it 6-8 inches deep.
Is that right?
And then when it gets there about 2 days and 2 nights, you go back the next morning and it'll bust in the bottom, come up there and just show its mash and roll. Then you go to get your wood in ready. Mm-hmm. Now that's
That's great
life. I enjoy that, Lord. Yeah. Many a cold morning, boy, I'm telling you, especially sweet mash, if you put cold beer in that thump barrel, you can hear them all. Oh, that's some life. You go, as old as I am and broke down and disabled, when you put up a good still, just send me word and I'll come home. Lord, no, Lord. I just... Man, I'd love to see one more going in my days.
Yeah.
But.
That's Theodore King. Okay, one thing that I found out in one of my early theses was that these moonshiners were Scotch-Irish, but I found out that not all moonshiners are Scotch-Irish, and certainly not all Scotch-Irish are moonshiners. And let's go back to Thee King and hear what he had to say about this.
Well, I take my flutter mill. My tongue loose, tied the middle loose of both ends. Now, where I take my racket at is my grandmother's a thoroughbred horseman.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, a redhead horseman, all right. Then my grandmother King was a thoroughbred Englishman.
Yeah,
I can't speak English.
Yeah, right.
Grandpa King was a thoroughbred Cherokee Indian.
Yeah.
My grandpa Pitt was a thoroughbred German.
Yeah.
I'm four mixed up deal.
Yeah.
And I don't know where I take my sense of reason and what little common horse sense they got. I believe it's out of Germans.
Yeah.
What is it? Well.
Okay, what he said there, I guess you got it there, was he said, I'm four bigs up, but I think I take my common sense from the Germans. Actually, I used this as a metaphor to describe the melting pot in the Appalachian area, particularly down the Great Philadelphia Wagon Road, which these people were Celts primarily. But he, of course, had a Cherokee background, and you had a lot of Cherokees who were in moonshining, and he had a German background as well as English and Scotch-Irish. Okay, the moonshiners, they developed great skills in camouflaging their stills. Let's go back to Hamper McBee, and I'll pass a photograph of Hamper around for you to take a look at him.
Most people, I don't make whiskey around our town. The people I work with, it ain't like you out here trying to beat the gum out of money. They're just doing it for a living. Most people make whiskey, got big families to feed anyway. And here come that man that axe and get on you, chop that thing down, make it look terrible. don't know why I won't fool with anybody like that for them. I mean, people are making that whiskey, they ain't making enough. It's going to hurt the government on their taxes. They go around and they run 10 gallon a week's time, sir. That ain't hurt the government's bad. For that, bro, well, just donate them all we got. There ain't too many in operation right around there at home, around close to home now, like it used to be. You used to find one in every spring, branch. Well, you take them in the wintertime, and one reason you don't see so many of them, you got packets for all them mountains. You got a hide still in the winter, all the leaves off the bushes, and you can see one for a mile. And last week we carried any out, we carried and packing it 2 miles up a mountain. Of course, when the leaves get on the bushes, you can put it out on top, see. But you take them in the wintertime, you got to get under that bluff and hide that thing. Or somebody find it, sure. They don't get out and hunt them themselves. They know where they at for to go. People snitching y'all. They used to pay them a little old reward, I think $25 to give a man to turn up a rig. I don't even know whether they do that anymore or not. But that old boy down there, when we got caught that time, he'd be down there with us. He'd come down and help us cut wood and get up steam. Then went and called a man on us. Lord, those officers looking sight, and they got through using that axe on their wood. Don't like it either. Had to tear them saplings down. They thought I'd strive well. I was riding bushes big as my leg getting away. Well, boy, about I working with it, just got out of jail. He'd been laying out there an hour a month, about 60-something days, and he couldn't run. He's just too weak to run. They had been feeding him too good out there. He said they feeding him just right. They feeding him just enough to keep him alive, and there was so much he'd keep him so fat he couldn't crawl out through the bars.
Okay, that was Hamper. You know, of all the moonshiners I met, and I don't have a tape to play for you, was semi-free of Rabun County, up in the Foxfire country in Rabun County in North Georgia. Semi-free, he was a diminutive little Scotch-Irish leprechaun. Just a wonderful guy. And the first day when I got there, I drove up to the backyard, went to the kitchen door, and Semi came and he met me and he shook hands with me and welcomed me and he went into the living room and he said, "Miss Annie," he said, "do you know this young man?" She said, "I've never seen him before in my life." He said, "Well, that's all right. We're just glad to have Ewens come in and visit with us and pull up a chair." So that was the first of about 10 times that I went up to see Semi in Tiger, Georgia, which is now, I think, right in the winery country of North Georgia, up there near Clayton, Georgia. He pointed to a tintype on the wall. He said, "You see that picture?" He said, "That's my father. He lived to be 109 years old." Said, "And you know the old scudder fooled around, let liquor kill him?" He said, "That's the story me and the preacher tell on him." He said, he didn't like for good corn whiskey right up until the time he died. And he said, "Yeah, they had me down there in South Maple Street in Gainesville. That's the Hall County Jail." But he said, "I didn't care. I wanted to see the world anyhow." Semi was a wonderful guy. When the Today Show, when Scribner's got me on the Today Show, the producer asked me, we're talking about 30 years, we're talking about 1974. The producer asked me, he said, "Would you bring us some samples?" And so I went up to see Semi. Semi said, "You really going to be on the Today Show?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I want you to tell those folks something for me." I said, "What's that, Sims?" He said, "Tell them I watch the Today Show every day, and I think that Barbara Walters is as sharp as a split splinter." What a guy. And this is Sims. And then there was the unforgettable Maud Thacker of Tate, Georgia. Maud Thacker, she I don't know if any of y'all ever knew Celestine Sibley, who was a columnist on the Constitution who died 3 years ago. She was a real tall mountaineer gal. She was her father's number one still hand. At the still, he had about 130 acres at the foot of Hendricks Mountain, which is now the Bent Tree Resort. And Maud would haul in the meal and the sugar and bring out the whiskey. And she would take a mule and snake out logs from the from the mountainside. Just a great gal, but she left the moonshine life, moved into Tate, married a Baptist preacher, and started making wine. Made great elderberry and fox grape wine. My wife Suzanne was a teetotaler until she tasted some of Miss Maud's fox grape wine. Just absolutely wonderful. She would go out and pick these fox grapes and other grapes and make her wine out in her smokehouse. Charles Corrault asked me to get together some moonshiners for one of his programs or one of his series, and I recruited Maud, and she became an instant celebrity in her end of Pickens County. And for Charles Corrault, she played her pump organ and sang the old English ballad, Barbara Allen. It was in the merry month of May when the green buds, they were swelling. Young Willie on his deathbed lay for the love of Barbara Allen. Well, here's Maud. Wonderful gal. I guess the greatest revenue that I ran into was Duff Floyd. Duff Floyd was a tall, genial, Gary Cooper type, never wore a gun, even when he was going into Raid of Steel. He lived in Jasper, Georgia, in Pickens County, not too far from Maud Thacker's home. His bosses with the ATF told him to stay away from a lot of the sheriffs, because the sheriffs were usually right in. If you wanted to find out where to get some real good corn whiskey, you would always try to make friends with the sheriff. But he said, you know, even though they told me that these sheriffs were part of the moonshine network, he thought that it would be worthwhile to get to know the sheriffs, and in particular, there was one, Charlie Crawford, over in Dawson County. And Dawson County was one of the top moonshine producing counties in the country back in the 30s during the Depression's years. But Duff thought it was prudent to get to know the sheriffs in his district, because he said, you know, you might get in trouble sometime. It'd be worthwhile to be on the good side of the sheriff. So one night, Duff was in a new car with another revenueer between Dawsonville and Dahlonega, waiting. They knew there was some whiskey that was going to be run down that night. They had some intelligence, some good intelligence. And sure enough, this whiskey car comes rolling by, I mean, and with the rear part of the vehicle loaded down, hanging low, and they took off after him. Well, when they got to the Dawsonville Square, they squealed around the curve there and went out on Highway 53 going toward Jasper, and all of a sudden there was a loud kaboom, kaboom, and their rear tires went down, and then out walks Charlie Crawford from behind his smoke with his double-barrel shotgun, Sheriff Charlie Crawford. And then when the smoke cleared, he says, "Damn, Duff, I didn't know it was you." So we declared war on the moonshiner, the trippers tonight, and we thought you were one of them. Said, "I arrested my own son here," and said he had never seen such an embarrassed guy as old Sheriff Charlie Crawford. Well, someone asked me, and I might mention, let me just go ahead and tell you some more stories here. Duff Floyd, one of the big characters that he captured and had under surveillance for many years was the Moonshine King of Georgia, John Henry Hardin, from Cherokee County, Georgia. Well, they finally caught the old guy, and he was convicted in federal court, and they had him in lockup right behind the judge's bench. And Duff took him a bouquet of roses. and gave it to the moonshiner. And the old man broke down and cried. When Duff Floyd told him, he said, "We just want you to know that we never did come after you because we didn't like you." Because there was a cat and mouse game between the revenuers and the moonshiners back then. Unlike in the 1800s, back when it was really serious, there was a lot of gunplay back then. But anyway, someone asked me how in the world I got hold of all these characters, and as I mentioned, I looked for retirees, and I got a lot of help. Celestine Sibley wrote a column, and as a result of that column, I got a letter from Mrs. Alan Wansley of Cornelia, Georgia, and she said, "You ought to come up and meet my revenue father, David Ayers, state revenue." Said he's been a revenue for 35 years, and I've interviewed him for quite a while. And then he said, "Do you know Duff Floyd?" And so I said, "No." He said, "Well," he told me to go over and meet Duff Floyd in Jasper, Georgia. Well, I went up and interviewed Duff many, many times, and Duff said, "Well, do you know Hubert Howell?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, Hubert Howell was a moonshiner who worked with John Henry Harden, and he could tell you a lot of stories." And I went to see Hubert Howell, and Hubert said, "You know, old Duff never did catch me." But they knew one another very well. And as I mentioned later, Duff took this bouquet of roses to John Henry Harden. And you know, Celestine Sibley of Constitution was covering the trial. And she said he looked just like George Washington, John Henry Harden, the Moonshine King of Georgia, and said he was a guy who had a reputation of never telling a lie. Well, you know, one thing about the moonshiners, when I first got started on this, I thought they would be ashamed of having been in the moonshine business, illegal, a lot of being condemned by the preachers and so forth. But I learned pretty quickly after I started interviewing these people, but they were proud of what they were doing, because a lot of them were able to put shoes on their children's feet and clothes on their back and food for the families by making whiskey. And you know, when the book came out, the Chamber of Commerce in Dahlonega, Georgia they sponsored the first annual Appalachian Ex-Moonshiners and Revenuers Convention. And one moonshine, and so I had ended up with photographs of all these moonshiners, their names, the whole shooting match. And of course, they were retired, but one moonshiner came up to me, old Buck Carver of Dillard, Georgia in Rabun County. He said, "Joe, there's only one thing wrong with that book." And I said, "What's that, Buck?" He said, "That's that you do not have my photograph and name in your book." And he said, "I understand why. I was in the hospital when you came by to get me to sign the disclaimer." So we had, I said, "Okay, I'm going to do a sequel," which I did, called More Mountain Spirits. And we got Buck's photograph in there. Later on, Buck was involved in his kids had told him not to drive any, but he drove and he got out and he was in a head-on collision. There were many stories of great pathos. There was the story of Roland Red Eye Barnes from up at Track Rock Gap, Georgia. He had it made, really, Red Eye did, like a lot of these moonshiners. He had a big farm. He had a 200-acre farm. He did a lot of farming. He made whiskey, and he fought chickens. But Red Eye got caught, like most of them did. He lost it all, and he and his wife were separated. He was living in the living room. She was living in the kitchen. Well, old Red Eye got pretty desperate, though, and he got down on his knees. He went into the kitchen and got down on his knees with his wife, and they prayed, and So they came to the conclusion that let's call the preacher. So that's what they did. They called the preacher. The preacher came. His name was Ryan Searight. He's about almost 7 feet tall. One of my buddies, my classmates from Berry College. And Ryan came out, and they prayed some more. And he said, let's go out and get your whiskey. And so they went out to his stash and his stump, and his last jar of moonshine, a half gallon of white whiskey, old Red Eye told me, he said, we poured it all out. Well, Red Eye served his term, left the North Georgia mountains, moved down to Gwinnett County, and became a preacher. So after 2 years of fermentation and a little more of distillation, this book, Mountain Spirits, was published, and I'm proud of it, really. It, like Foxfire, it tells this story of a bygone era, and as I mentioned, these tapes were done 30 years ago, so it's just about of course, there is still moonshining, and occasionally, but a lot of the younger people are turning to other pursuits like drugs and so forth, but there's not the camaraderie with the law like it was back then. Well, the book was well received, and Scribner's flew me and my 12-year-old son Scott to New York. They put us up in the Algonquin Hotel. I'd been to the 25th reunion of our college class, and I asked one of my preacher buddies, old Herschel Sheets, who became a Methodist superintendent there in Atlanta. I said, Herschel, how about praying for me? I've never been on live TV before. I guess he did, because I woke up there at the Algonquin early that morning singing His Eyes on the Sparrow. And I sang that the rest of the day as Scott and I walked up Fifth Avenue to the NBC studios. And of course, I had that sample. But when I got up to the studios, this producer said, what in the devil are you doing with that? Get that stuff out of here. But anyway, program went well. And afterward, my son Scott wanted to do one thing. He wanted to ride the subway. So the Scribner's editor there from 597 Fifth Avenue in New York, he put us on the subway to the World Trade Center. The first tower had just been built. And as we got on the train, there's a black guy reached out his hand and he said, hey, I saw you on the Today Show. You did well. Okay, I've got one more tape, and I think you'll recognize who this is, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
America, the mountain moonshiner survives in the southern highlands. I know of a man not 5 minutes' drive up a little twisty road in the mountains of Virginia who can supply you with a mason jar of white lightning of his own manufacture. He learned how from his daddy, who learned how from his daddy. This goes way back. In the heroic age, Bernard DeVoto wrote, our forefathers invented self-government, the Constitution, and bourbon. Well, moonshining isn't what it used to be, but hidden in this hollow and that drawer remain white whiskey stills that turn out 8 or 9 million gallons every year just the same. The story of what moonshining was and is a story I've been reading while passing through the moonshine territory recently in a lovely, absorbing book by Joseph Earl Dabney called Mountain Spirit. It rewards the reader who doesn't even care about corn liquor, but who does care about our rural past. Here's old Hubert Howell, North Georgia ex-moonshiner, speaking of Duck Floyd, ex-revenuer. I thought a lot of Duck Floyd. He's a fine man. You tell him if you see him anymore, I'd love to see him. You tell him I can yet outrun him. And here's a mountain conversation. Hey, George, your corn crop is looking good. How much do you think you're going to make to the acre? Oh, about 100 gallons. Mr. Dabney tells how Junior Samples had to hide in the woods from the revenue man. Lying on the ground, all he could hear was his Ingersoll watch ticking loudly in his overalls. He dug a hole and buried it. Interstate highways crisscross the Blue Ridge now. Little towns are growing into cities. The mountain moonshiner knows the times and the law are against him. He believes the times and the law are wrong. The drip, drip of the pure white liquid is still heard in the mason jars in the quiet places.
Thank you very much. Be happy to answer any questions.
A question for Joe?
What'd they sell it for? How much?
Well, back then you could get a half gallon of brandy for about $40. I don't know what it sells for today, to tell you the truth. Most of the stuff that I get now, and I have some fairly fresh brandy that I'll take there tonight. It's just given to me. But it's, there's still a little bit of moonshining going on, and there are certain markets in metro areas. It has to be, the price has to be a lot less than tax-paid whiskey, of course. That's one of the primary reasons for it. Is it more what? Well, when it gets to the shot houses, what they do, they cut it quite a bit with water, and they sell it by the shot. But there are people who make brandy for their friends, and they just give it to them. I don't think there's a real big market. Of course, this is 30 years ago. I mean, I haven't really been researching this project recently.
What do these folks use for yeast for their fermentation? Did they use bread yeast, or did they depend on wild yeast?
They would use commercial yeast. Now, sometimes they would make, they would sprout corn for their, and sometimes it would rye they would buy, but they would sprout and when they sprouted the corn, they would wet it down and put it in a toe sack or something like that, and let it dry and let it sprout, and that way once it was dry, they ground it up.
Also have regarding the price of moonshine. There's actually quite a lively market in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, of moonshine that comes from about three counties in Virginia.
Yeah.
And in the shot houses, it's about $1 a shot.
Is that what it's selling for?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one little spot in western Virginia, way over in, pretty close to Christiansburg. And it's still going on there. But that's about the only place that I know of any major production right now. But what do you say, how much for a shot?
Dollar shot.
Well, thanks very much.